Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. And this time we're going deep into Darkseid Dreamwalker.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's a sci-fi novel. From what I've read so far, it's pretty bizarre.
Okay, I'm intrigued. So what can you tell us about this Darkseid Dreamwalker?
Well, it's written by E.J. Gold, and you guys sent over some excerpts from the book, and I gotta say, it's not your typical space opera.
Okay, so not your typical space opera. So, like, what makes it stand out? What's so different?
Well, for one thing, we've got a detective who's, she's got these wording ways. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Wiving ways.
Yeah.
Not ringing a bell.
Yeah, it's like a sort of a sixth sense intuition, maybe a touch of precognition, but not quite magic. And then there's also this whole thing about a laser tampon.
Whoa, hold on. A laser tampon. Did I hear that right?
You heard right. It's a weapon. Yeah.
Okay. Color me intrigued. But before we delve into the weaponry, maybe you could set the scene for us a little bit. Where does all this take place?
Yeah, so the story unfolds mostly in this place called Bardo Town. It's on the dark side. It's perpetually dark. The buildings don't have any windows. Food is synthetic.
Okay, so not exactly a vacation destination.
Not really, no. And then there's this whole one-person, one-room rule. It's like a very strictly controlled society. And this is all in stark contrast to the light side, which is symbolized by New Springfield, which I'm guessing is supposed to be like our world.
Okay, so we've got this dichotomy already, right? The dark side versus the light side. This Bardo Town sounds kind of dystopian, maybe even a little creepy.
Yeah, it's got this kind of noir feel to it, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But then Gold throws in all this futuristic tech, aliens, and it gets, well, pretty wild.
Okay, so in this, let's call it unconventional setting, we've got a detective with writing ways and a laser tampon. What else? Who are the other players in this story?
Right. So our main character, the detective, is Lieutenant. She gets promoted to captain later on. Her name is Ginger Rogers. And she's dealing with all sorts of interesting characters. Like there's this President Booth who shows up from the light side.
President Booth. Okay, so we've got some political intrigue going on here, too.
Well, Booth is looking for his missing wife, Mary Todd. But he's not exactly traveling alone.
He's got Secret Service, right. I mean, he is the president.
Oh, yeah, he's got security and all that. But he's also got this companion, this bird of perdition.
Bird of what now?
Bird of perdition. It's called Boo Pee for short. And it's this creature with a woman's face and suction cups for feet. And it just spouts lines from, like, gothic novels.
Whoa, okay. I officially have no idea what's going on anymore. But I am, like, 100% on board. So this Boo Pee, it's like some kind of pet advisor. What's the deal with this thing?
Booth claims it's the, like, conscience of the people of New Springfield. You know, it latches onto wrongdoers, but honestly, it's hard to tell if it's a moral compass or just adding to the chaos.
Okay, so we've got this clash of personalities right from the start. The light side president with his unusual companion, and then this whole dark side vibe. And I'm guessing these two worlds don't exactly see eye to eye.
No, definitely not. And it goes beyond just the geographical differences, you know, their whole worldview, their values, even what they consider entertaining. Like when Booth first encounters the Darkseid's VR entertainment system, he's totally horrified.
Oh yeah, VR. What's their take on that?
Oh, on the light side, you know, entertainment might be more, I don't know, sanitized, maybe focused on individual choice. But the Darkseid system, it seems much more intrusive, maybe reflecting a different relationship with technology.
So it's not just about escapism.
Right. It's almost like the Darkseid is using technology to control people's experiences, their perceptions. Mm. Booth is really disturbed by it. He sees it as a violation.
Makes you think about the power of technology, right?
Yeah.
And who controls it.
Exactly. And this whole idea of cultural clash becomes even more apparent when they visit the Darkseid's version of the Empire State Restaurant.
Wait, they have an Empire State restaurant on the dark side. I mean, talk about cultural appropriation.
It's not quite the same, you know. This one has, like, multi-gravity environments to cater to all sorts of alien clientele.
Yeah.
But the food. Oh, man, the food. Booth is, like, totally disgusted by it.
I mean, it is the dark side. What did he expect? Farm to table?
Right. It's all synthetic. And Booth just can't wrap his head around the fact that nobody seems to grasp the concept of real ingredients.
So we've got this clash over food, too. It's like, is it just about taste? Or is it something deeper, you know? Is Booth clinging to a way of life that the dark side has just, like, moved beyond?
I think it's definitely about more than just taste. It's about values,
yeah.
About tradition, about what we consider essential to our humanity.
Okay, so cultural clashes, a missing wife, a detective who can practically see the future. Where does this wild ride take us next?
Well, their search for Mary Todd leads them to the Off-Broadway Theater District, of all places. And it's there they find a play that's way more than just entertainment. It's like it becomes this mirror reflecting the themes of the novel itself, this play within a play thing.
I love it when stories get all meta. Always makes you think. So what's this play all about?
It's called Pool of the Moon. It's this satire about insurance fraud and legal proceedings. And of course, the Bird of Perdition has to chime in with its, let's call it colorful commentary.
The BBOP. I can only imagine. So we're getting some social commentary in there too.
Yeah, Gold seems to be saying that even in this, you know, bizarre future world, some things never change. The desire for wealth, the loopholes in the system, it's all very human, even if the characters aren't. And,
yeah.
And this is where things start to get really interesting. It's almost like Gold is using this play to hold up a mirror to our own society. You know, those same themes of greed and corruption, they're timeless.
Yeah, and they transcend genre too. It's like he's saying, no matter how futuristic or fantastical the setting, human nature is always a factor.
Absolutely. But back to this play, Pool of the Moon. This is actually where Booth finds Mary Todd.
Oh, wow, really? So she's in the play.
Yeah, she's going by the stage name Mary Todd Booth, but it's definitely her. Turns out she's been living out her dream of being a live actress, which is, I guess, kind of ironic considering how much Booth hates the dark side's entertainment.
Yeah, that's a pretty big coincidence. Or is it? I mean, maybe Gold is hinting at something deeper there. Like, maybe Mary Todd is rejecting the light side's values, choosing this more authentic, even if it's dangerous, life on the dark side.
That's an interesting take. It definitely makes you think about what she's really searching for, you know? What's driving her choices?
Totally. But she's not the only one Booth takes an interest in. There's also this actor, Jack Black, who's playing multiple roles in the play.
Right, Jack Black. Now, Booth needs a Lincoln impersonator for some reason, and he fixates on this guy.
Okay. So Booth wants to pluck this guy out of this bizarre dystopian world and bring him back to the light side. That's got to be a culture shock.
Yeah, and Booth really plays up the contrast between the two worlds. He promises Black all these things like home ownership, financial security, you know, things that seem totally out of reach on the dark side.
I see. So it's like he's dangling this carrot in front of him, this promise of a better life. But is it really better? I mean, who's to say what better even means in this context?
Exactly. And it makes you question Booth's motives, too. Is he genuinely trying to help Black? Or is he just exploiting him, using him for his own purposes?
That's the thing with these complex characters, right? You never really know what their true intentions are. There's always this element of ambiguity.
Yeah, and Gold does a great job of keeping us guessing. So Booth heads back to the light side with his wife and his newly acquired Lincoln impersonator. But meanwhile, back on the dark side, Ginger Rogers is facing her own set of challenges.
Okay, so what's Rogers up to now?
Well, for one thing, she gets promoted to captain. But she's also got this new case, a series of torso murders in the industrial burbs, and she's specifically told to stay out of it.
Oh, I bet she does. Rogers doesn't strike me as the type to just follow orders blindly.
You got that right. She's driven by this need for justice, a need to understand. So she goes undercover, and this leads her to a character who's, well, he's as fascinating as Rogers herself. Dr. Ackerman.
Dr. Ackerman. Okay, tell me more about this guy. What makes him so fascinating?
Well, he's a scientist, and his house is crammed with, like, all this sci-fi memorabilia. You name it, he's got it. Robots, spaceships, ray guns. The guy is living his passion.
I love that. A sci-fi fanatic in a sci-fi world. So meta.
Right. It's like Gold is winking at us, the readers.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Ackerman isn't just collecting souvenirs. He's obsessed with creating synthetic life forms.
Ooh, synthetic life forms. That's getting into some pretty deep territory. It's like, what does it even mean to be alive? And who gets to decide?
Exactly. And if Dr. Ackerman's creations are truly sentient, what rights do they have? It's a question that's been explored in sci-fi forever.
It makes it think about, like, the ethics of technology, you know? Mm-hmm. Are we playing God? And if so, what are the consequences?
And it turns out that Dr. Ackerman is connected to those torso murders. But it's not like he's some evil mastermind, you know, it's more complicated than that.
Okay, so what's the deal with the murders?
He's not killing people out of malice. It's more like he's taking them apart, trying to understand how life works, how to recreate it. It's like a really twisted version of Booth's disgust with the synthetic food. They're both searching for something authentic, but their methods are, well, pretty extreme.
That's an interesting parallel. They're both obsessed with this idea of genuineness, of what's real, but they go about it in completely different ways.
Right. And this is where things get really dangerous for Dr. Ackerman. The mayor decides to use the torso murders as an excuse to impose martial law on the industrial burbs.
Classic power play. Exploit fear, restrict freedoms, consolidate control. It's like no matter what world you're in, there's always someone trying to grab more power.
And Rogers, being Rogers, recognizes the injustice of the situation. She stages this whole elaborate scene to protect Dr. Ackerman from the authorities, even though it means putting her own career at risk.
She's got a strong moral compass, that's for sure. She's not just blindly following orders. She's making judgments based on what she believes is right, even if it means breaking the rules.
And that kind of independent thinking, that willingness to go against the grain, it makes you wonder if that's something that's nurtured on the dark side. You know, this constant chaos and uncertainty, maybe it breeds a certain resourcefulness.
Yeah, maybe. Like, you have to be able to think on your feet, adapt to whatever situation you're thrown into.
And Rogers definitely needs all her resourcefulness for her next assignment. She gets sent to the Grimpenmeyer, this hostile environment where human mining operations are under constant attack from something truly unsettling.
Okay, the Grimpenmeyer. What's out there? What are they up against?
Mudworms.
Mudworms, like regular earthworms.
No, not like regular earthworms. Mm-hmm. These things are huge. And they're not just mindless creatures either. They have this collective intelligence. They operate as a unit, a single organism, and they're relentless.
Whoa, that's creepy. So it's like they're facing a hive mind.
Exactly. And this is where Gold really flips the script on the typical monster movie. We're used to seeing individual threats, you know, creatures with distinct personalities and motivations. But the mudworms, they're something else entirely. They're the unknown, the vastness of nature, and they just don't care about human rules or logic.
So it's like nature versus technology, this unstoppable force that just keeps coming no matter what you throw at it.
And in the midst of this whole, like, desperate fight for survival, something truly bizarre happens. Rogers comes face to face with a being that seems completely out of place in this whole gritty sci-fi world.
A genie.
Wait a second, a genie, like it wishes and magic lamps, that kind of genie. You got it. But this isn't your typical, you know, grant you three wishes genie. This one claims to be the true inventor of electricity.
Well, okay, now that's a twist I did not see coming. So what's a genie doing in this story? And why is he so focused on electricity?
He claims he was cheated out of his patents by, wait for it, Benjamin Franklin.
No way. Benjamin Franklin, like the founding father.
The one and only. And this genie has been trapped inside a ruby for centuries, just stewing in his resentment. He wants revenge.
Okay, I have so many questions. But first, how does a genie get trapped in a ruby? And why is he so fixated on Benjamin Franklin after all this time?
Well, it's a long story. But to answer your first question, he was tricked by a sorceress who was jealous of his powers. And as for Franklin, well, let's just say the genie has a bit of an ego, and he can't stand the thought of someone else getting credit for his invention.
I mean, I get it, but still, centuries of planning just to get back at Benjamin Franklin seems a little excessive, even for a genie.
Tell me about it. But that's the thing about this genie. He's got all this power, but he's also incredibly petty and vindictive. It's a hilarious and kind of disturbing combination.
So what happens? Does he, like, go on a rampage, zap people with lightning bolts?
Pretty much. He's not exactly known for his subtlety. Anyone who disagrees with him or, you know, questions his claim to fame, they get turned into a pile of ash.
Yikes. Sounds like someone needs an anger management class.
Right. And it's up to Rogers to try and, de-escalate the situation before things get completely out of control.
So how does she handle a vengeful genie? I mean, that's not exactly covered in the detective's handbook.
She tries to reason with him. She explains the complexities of patent law. But this genie, he's so blinded by rage, he's not really listening. It's this classic clash between rationality and raw emotion.
Okay, I gotta know, how do you even begin to argue patent law with a genie?
Well, Roger's a pretty sharp cookie. She knows her stuff. And eventually she managed to find the loophole, a way to outsmart the genie.
A loophole. What kind of loophole can you use against a being who can control electricity?
A legal one. It turns out even genies have to abide by the laws of man. At least when it comes to intellectual property.
Okay, you gotta tell me more. What's the legal loophole? How does she outsmart him?
She points out a very simple fact that the genie, in his, you know, centuries-long quest for vengeance, had completely overlooked. Patents expire. 17 years. And then the invention is public domain.
Whoa. So all that anger, all that planning, for nothing. That's gotta be a tough pill to swallow.
You think? It's this incredibly anticlimactic moment, this all-powerful being brought down not by some epic battle, but by, like, bureaucratic red tape.
It's brilliant. Goal is really playing with our expectations here, subverting the typical hero versus villain trope.
Exactly. And it's not just about humor either. It makes you think about, like, what is true justice? Is it revenge? Or is it something more nuanced?
And what happens to the genie? Does he just accept defeat? Disappear in a puff of smoke?
Not exactly. He realizes the absurdity of the situation. All those wasted centuries. And in a moment of despair, he turns the ruby's power on himself. Chooses oblivion over the burden of his regret.
Oh, wow. So it's a tragic ending for the genie.
In a way, yeah. But it's also kind of a release. Like, maybe he finally finds peace by letting go of all that anger and resentment.
It's a really poignant moment. Makes you think about the destructive nature of holding on to grudges, you know?
Absolutely. But unfortunately for Rogers, there's not much time for reflection. She's still got those mudworms to deal with.
Right, the mudworms. I'd almost forgotten about them. What happens with that whole situation?
She eventually makes it back to the Grim and Mire, and the battle is just as intense, just as desperate as we left it. The defenders are trapped inside this bunker, their resources are dwindling, and the mudworms are just relentless.
So it's a siege situation. They're just holding on for dear life.
Pretty much. And Goal really paints this vivid picture of, like, the claustrophobia of the bunker, the constant fear of the unknown lurking just outside. It's a reminder that even with genies and laser tampons and all this other crazy stuff, some conflicts just can't be resolved with a snap of the fingers.
Yeah, sometimes there are no easy answers, no magic solutions.
And the ending of the novel? Well, it's even more ambiguous than the genie's fate. Rogers finds herself back in that shop, Shottlebop. But this time, something's different. She's stuck in a time loop, reliving the same encounter over and over.
Wait, a time loop, like Groundhog Day style?
Kind of. But each time she enters the shop, there's a different author at the typewriter, starting a new version of her story.
Whoa. So it's like she's a character in someone else's story.
Yeah.
And they keep rewriting her reality.
Exactly. And Gold never tells us who these authors are or what their motives are. He just leaves us with this image of Rogers trapped in this endless cycle of rewrites, her fate constantly being reshaped by whoever happens to be holding the pen.
That is mind-blowing. It's like he's questioning the whole nature of authorship, of narrative control. And it's the perfect ending for a novel that's all about challenging our perceptions of reality.
It really makes you think about, like, who's in control of the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we tell about the world.
And what happens when those stories start to unravel, when the lines between fiction and reality blur?
It's a question that's as old as storytelling itself. And Darkside Dreamwalker offers a fresh and, well, pretty bizarre perspective on this age-old dilemma. Okay, so we've gone pretty deep into this crazy world of Darkside Dreamwalker. Laser tampons, a genie suing Benjamin Franklin, mudworms with hive minds. I mean, where do we even begin to unpack all of this?
Right. It's a lot to process, but I think that's what makes this book so fascinating. It's not just a wild ride, you know? It's got these layers of meaning, these big ideas that really make you think.
Yeah, like, one of the things that really stood out to me was this whole clash of cultures thing. And I'm not just talking about the light side versus the dark side.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. You know, humans and aliens, tradition versus progress, even, like, individual desires versus the needs of society.
It's like Gold is holding up this funhouse mirror to our own world.
Yeah.
You know, he's exaggerating these conflicts we see in our own lives, but he's also forcing us to examine them from a different perspective. Like, take Booth's reaction to the synthetic food. On the surface, it's just this kind of funny, you know, ew, gross.
Right. But it goes deeper than that. It's about, like, what we value, what we consider essential to our humanity.
Exactly. And on the dark side, maybe those values have shifted, you know? They've adapted to this world of scarcity, of artificiality. So it makes you question, like, what's truly important? What are we willing to sacrifice in the name of progress, of survival?
And that whole thing about the VR entertainment system, too. It's like, on the one hand, it's this super advanced technology. But on the other hand, it's this tool for control, for manipulation.
Right. And it makes you think about the technology we're developing today.
Yeah.
You know, social media, artificial intelligence, all these amazing tools that have the potential to connect us, to empower us. But they can also be used to exploit us, to control us.
And Darkside Dreamwalker doesn't shy away from those darker implications. It's like Gold is saying, hey, pay attention. These are the things we need to be thinking about.
Absolutely. It's a cautionary tale, but it's also a celebration of human ingenuity. of our ability to adapt, to overcome challenges.
And even when things seem bleak, there's this underlying sense of hope. Like with Rogers, you know, she's facing all these impossible odds, but she never gives up. She keeps fighting for what she believes in.
And even with the genie, as tragic as his ending is, there's this element of redemption. He finally lets go of his anger, his resentment. He finds a kind of peace.
Right. It's like, even in the darkest of times, there's always the possibility for change, for growth. And then there's that ending with the time loop and the multiple authors. It's like Gold is throwing this whole concept of reality into question.
It's like he's saying, what if everything we know is just a story? A story that's constantly being rewritten, revised, reinterpreted.
It's mind-blowing, really.
Yeah.
It makes you think about the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we tell about the world, and who gets to control those stories.
And how do those stories shape our reality, our beliefs, our values, our actions?
So after this whole deep dive into Darkseid Dreamwalker, I think I'm left with more questions than answers.
Me too. But isn't that the point of great art? To provoke us, to challenge us, to make us think differently about the world?
Absolutely. And I think Darkseid Dreamwalker definitely achieves that. It's a wild, thought-provoking, and ultimately unforgettable journey.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, folks, that's about all the time we have for today. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive into the bizarre and brilliant world of Darkseid Dreamwalker. And as always, thanks for listening.